Yes, what we knew that what could be done was that we knew that many schools had weak departments, perhaps it was a language or maybe math or whatever. And we felt that we could get master teachers, the very best, who could produce classes for every school that needed them, and that the money would be forthcoming to have at least a television, a camera, and a reproducer there right in the schools. And she, of course, really could see the potential and the need, and she said she would talk further to Dr. Dimmick. And she must have been very persuasive, because Dr. Dimmick eventually became a very loyal supporter of WQED after he really saw the difference between 2 hours a day or 2 hours every day, 5 days a week. And this would be a much longer schedule and much more potential to help the youngsters. So that's how we did bring in the school programs. Now, we did not use those, as you know, after a certain hour in the afternoon. Then we had children programs, and you know that Fred Rogers, who is a doctor, Dr. Rogers, he's a minister, you know that his program became nationally syndicated and also in Canada, and that he has had a tremendous influence in quality programming for children. He would have his hour, and there would be other good things for children, story hours and so forth. And then the evening hours were cultural programming.
What about the adult education? There was a program enabling adults to earn
that
a diploma.
Was, yes, a high school diploma. That was done through Dr. Harry Snyder from the public schools, who worked in the adult education division. And he handled that, and it was, we had a number of classes that were graduated and people got their high school diplomas, which was great, and including some classes, as you may recall, that went to the prisoners in various mm-hmm. prisons, where many of them were able to earn a degree. It was a very sound idea, and it lasted for about 6 years. And then I think Dr. Snyder had, we couldn't afford to do it anymore. I forget what the financial problem was. The schools either didn't allocate it or the tax money ran out, something, and it was dropped. And I always felt so badly about that. Now, there were college programs, but they were done nationally and from New York, and they were called the, what was it, the early Sunrise School or whatever.
Yes,
they were college
yes.
level, and many people here, as they did elsewhere, took those programs. Some of them are still extant, but I don't know how many. I can't tell you that.
Mrs. Elvis, I believe you were executive producer of public and community affairs
for a number of years, yes.
That was aside from the educational television role.
Well, that was just to help start it.
I see.
After I had gotten the volunteer program started, and after we began to grow and had longer hours and became more professional, I felt that we had to have a permanent paid person for the numbers of volunteers that would still be used. They would be decreasing, but the quality had to remain high. And I said I felt it was time I left that post, and that I would prefer to be involved in some programming. And that's what I began to do. And we did have a professional handling of volunteers until, oh, I suppose it was fully 10 years after it was started, that we were without volunteers except for drives, you know, mm-hmm. and sometimes for mailings. The rest were all then professional paid people. And that's how I got involved in programming.
Well, we know that you produce two weekly programs that received many favorable reviews, Key to the City
yes.
and Women's Window.
That's true.
Could you tell us first something about Key to the City? What was the theme
well,
of the program?
Well, the whole idea, and it was mine, I think in this case I was something of a pioneer, it doesn't seem to be anything unusual anymore, was that we would interview even professors, maybe those who were visiting or those who were here, who were prominent in their fields on subjects that they knew a great deal about. I don't mean they were the only ones, but we really were the first channel in Pittsburgh, TV channel, that interviewed the professional campus community. And we had some wonderful people, because every good college has visiting professors, and we'd find out who they were. And either we read it or we asked the colleges to let us know. And when they came, we would interview them. We also were able to interview many other people who were coming into the city who had a great deal to say and were, in spite of their being interviewed on commercial television, very willing to come and talk to us. And that included anyone from a doctor to an author. And we worked very hard to get the type of people that we felt could do very well for us, and they all did, or at least 90% of them did.
This was unrehearsed, spontaneous?
Unrehearsed. I didn't even have a list of questions. I knew the subject, and then they were willing, I mean, enough to ask them the questions. Let's be very clear about that. That's about as much.
These were just visiting professionals from other cities?
As well as local people.
As well as local people.
Supposing somebody came in to head a drama department, or someone came in who was going to talk about atomic energy and was now developing an atomic energy department in the science of one of the universities. Anyone of that sort.
Did you choose particular topics and then invite the person, or?
Well, usually what they did and what they were teaching or what they had written was the basis of an interview.
Both men and women?
Oh, of course. I think also we can say with some pride that we were probably the very first interview group with Key to the City to invite black people of consequence, mm-hmm. young or old, to be guests. I think our very first one was a young man, I can't remember his name, who was training for the Olympics as a runner. He had won most of the events in the Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania area.
So really the subjects were from very diverse fields.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Was this a weekly program?
Yes.
Daytime?
Once a week. No,
evening. I see. And what they...
And of course, for years it was hard to do because we didn't have taping. So we couldn't make it ahead.
They
were live. It maybe made it a little more exciting, but it was also a very iffy thing because we had a time, I'll never forget it, where we'd invited, at the suggestion of the Pittsburgh University's Department of International Affairs, two Nigerians who were here studying, and they never appeared. And I forget who we corralled at the last minute, but it was enough to be ulcer-making, I can assure you. That was the one advantage of taping. And I think you'd be interested to know the reason that they never appeared. I found out later from Dean Stone that unfortunately the Nigerians in their own country live on a different time schedule mm-hmm. than we do. They might say, I'm coming over the bridge tomorrow at 4, but if it isn't convenient, they'll make it the next day at 4. And they can't quite understand our living by the clock, as you know we did. So they were very upset. They didn't mean to be rude, but some things had come up, and they thought if they came in the next day, they would have an opportunity. Well, alas, it didn't occur. But we had things like that happen all the time, you know, and that's when you're alive, that's the kind of thing you live with, you know. What can you do?
The best you can.
The very best you can, that's right.
What were the years this program was on the air?
Oh, it was on the air until I think I left the station, which was in 1974 or 3, I'm not quite sure.
Mm-hmm. 1954.
Well, no, I didn't. I think I went off 55, something like
that.
I
see. Well, that was quite a span of time.
Yes, yes, surprise.
Now, Women's Window, did it have a particular emphasis? Or?
Yes, it did. I think some of you may know, either by hearsay or watched, and maybe you like them. It had been my experience that most of the afternoon shows were soap operas and giveaway shows for women. And remember, in those days, more women were home with families or on their own than there are today. Though I understand the soap operas still have a very large group. But my feeling was, and I didn't realize how right I was, that there were many women who were home, perhaps older women and perhaps women with a good college education, who maybe had to stay home because they had little children and didn't want to have a babysitter, and many other women might want something a little more than a soap opera. And it was my idea to try and reach them in two different ways. One was to offer them reviews of books and articles that I thought were of particular interest to them in one way or another. And another thing was to bring in people that I thought would have a great deal of interest for them. Sometimes they were the very same people that I had used on Key to the City, but much more often they might be some specialist in a field I felt was of great interest for them. And it worked out, and then of course we would have other different things on the show, perhaps something about in the summer about planting, in the winter about how you kept your house warm, even then, conservation, whatever. And it turned out to be very, very well viewed. It really was. I can never forget. I have it somewhere in my heavy files that are stored somewhere. I'll never see it again as long as I'm alive. I have kept one letter I'll never forget. There were others like it. It came in on lined tablet paper and a plain, probably nickel envelope. It was written by a woman who said, "I can't thank you enough for Women's Window. I am the wife of a farmer, and I do my ironing in the kitchen, and I can't wait for your program because you always give me something that I can talk to my husband about when he comes in from the fields at night." It was a marvelous letter, a letter that a PR person couldn't have written better. I couldn't believe it, and it really was so outstanding that I kept that one letter very much. I couldn't help it. Furthermore, in cooperation with many agencies and groups, we would tell them where volunteer help was needed. And if they were interested, they knew where to call. And they did.
It was women-oriented.
Definitely. But we also found we had many men, yeah, because they were interested in the book reviews. They were interested in the type of people who were on and medical things and so forth. And we would have a number of letters from the men who were home. They were either retired, mm-hmm, or they went to work at night, or they were older. And I was surprised. The large audience was women, but there were men.
But both men and women were guests on your program.
Oh, yes. We never. Oh, mm-hmm. No. This was before raising women's consciousness, and it was not done in any condescending way. It was just the opposite, and it was wonderful to see the response.
It was very gratifying.
Yes, it was.
How did you choose your topics in order to get people?
Now, that, dear, I couldn't possibly tell you, because I'm a rather widely read person. Mm-hmm. I had a good liberal arts education, and I chose what I felt that anybody, even if they only had a high school education, but were interested in the world around them, had children, were doing something in the community or wanted to, would be interested in how to take a chance. But that's what one does when one creates something.
Do you recall any program of unusual interest that comes to your mind?
Oh, there were many, but it's very difficult for me to remember right now any particular one. I do know that it got to the point with the books that this I think is very related to what you said, though negatively. I remember that with the book reviews, there wasn't a bookstore in Pittsburgh or the areas that didn't sell out on that book if I gave it a good review. Now, let me come to the negative end of it. I found the last book of Edna Ferber's, which I think it was, what was it called, Alaska or something. Anyway, it was quite bad. And I unfortunately reviewed it and said it was not up to her quality, that it was not this, it was not that. And it still sold out. And so I decided in the future, I had learned from that. Edna Ferber, by the way, was a very good friend of my mother's. They were very good friends. I I decided the best thing to do was omit a review of a book that I thought was no good or not up to scratch, and I wouldn't review them. Because I discovered the power of television was so great that people
negative.
Would buy it, maybe just to see if I was right or they agreed with me. I don't know. But this was literally true, so the best thing was not to review it at all.
Well, that's an interesting observation.
To me, this is what worked out. I used the positive approach.
Mrs. Elkis, were you the sole person involved in both writing and producing both these programs?
Yes, I had an assistant always. Mm-hmm. I had to have that because there was an enormous amount of work involved in those programs every week, and the research and the people you had to see, and you had to plan ahead, you know. And I had one assistant, and I wrote them, yes, of course. I wrote them up, what I needed, sometimes just a few lead lines and other times the script. See, I also did documentaries for them. Which were special single shows.
I see. I believe you also did a weekly column on QED programs for papers.
Yes, that came out of the fact that I knew the Eugene Simon, who was then the owner of the Valley Daily News, which a paper he had developed from nothing. And he admired QED very much. And one day I said to him, well, if you could probably push our programs up there in the, Tarentum Valley, that's where the paper was published, if you had anything in a weekly column. And he said, well, if you'll write it, I'll see how our staff feels, and if it's good, we'll put it in. And they did. And I did it for the station. I mentioned programs and then also always gave a brief book review in there too, and it turned out to be successful, and I had to speak up there a number of times and in related communities where they also read that particular column.
And you wrote for QED magazine, the Renaissance also.
Yes, they asked me to write book reviews for them, which I did for several years until they changed the format.
When did you discontinue your active role in WQED?
In 1974.
74, I see. Do you have any present involvement?
With them, no, not directly at all. Mm-hmm. However, I am known to be a consultant in the field of, we don't call it education, we call it public broadcasting and cable television. And I was, for a period of number of years, I was the chairman, the state chairman for AAUW, American Association of University Women, of their mass media, and had to go all around the state. And when it came to testifying for the needs of cable in this area, I remember Pittsburgh National Bank from the commercial point of view, and I, as the media chairman for state AAUW, testified. I was not able to be there, but I wrote out the testimony, and another member of my committee presented it at the mayor's committee, that we felt there was a tremendous potential and a need for it, and that it would come along. We felt it was needed. And of course, I think it is. And I think it may change the role of all television, but we don't want to go into that. I just feel it will. But I felt there was a potential there.
No, there's no doubt about that. You mentioned early radio briefly. I believe you did programs for adults and children on radio.
Yes, particularly for children. I developed Let's Explore Music, which went into many public schools as well. I was on WWSW and then later on WTAE. It was, you know, when it was the radio.
Was that the program called History of American Song?
It was called Let's Explore Music. But that under that, I did the first series on ever done in this country on the history of American song. And researched it and wrote it. And I had a very fine young pianist named Annette Rosenson, who is now a teacher. I forget her married name, but anyway, she is now a teacher up in Clarion College, but she played my accompaniments. And this program, it's interesting you bring that up, went into a number of public schools where I presented it live. And that was not the when it was done on the radio, but they heard about it, and I was invited to go to different schools. And the way it worked was this. It was a program where if we did a composer who was classical, we didn't stress that. It was beautiful music. I wrote the translations, and they were always in simple English, not "Oh beauteous morn," but "Oh lovely morning," you know. And we did this because we felt that young people, children in their early teens or between 10 and 15, would respond to it if it wasn't made something they ought to listen to or something they couldn't understand. And it was on the air at WWSW, I think either 2 or 3 years, and was, then when I went to WTA, I think that's what it was, I can't remember, it was the old channel before television, which now, of course, they're on television, but it was broadcast over two-thirds of the Mutual Network every week. I went from WWSW to that station. And I did that for another year or two. And that was the history of music, of American music. That's when I was doing that. And the important thing there was the interest that had come about in the public schools. One of the schools I visited, and she recalled it years later, when we worked together for educational television, was one of Caroline Patterson's schools, the Linden School. And she said she remembered me from then. And it seemed so strange, you know, many years later, that this would come up.
Made an impression, evidently.
Well, she evidently liked it. She said, the children. I would tell you this. I often was scared to death because some of those schools were tough schools. And I didn't know if the kids would start throwing something. You could never tell.
Or be receptive.
And I went, I did it. And I went on accentuating the positive and relating. I introduced each song and explained it. And then, of course, in English, and I never had any problem, not even in the tough schools, to my utter amazement and great delight.
I've never heard anything like
scared to death.
Well, that was a real testimonial.
I don't know.
But you fascinated me.
Having been in schools, I can tell you.
You know. I think you just have to accentuate the positive and pray. I don't know what else you do.
That's a good formula.
Yeah.
Just that much to work. I was wondering whether you have such a wealth of material and you've done so much, so many creative things. Have you put this down in a textbook, a book of some kind?
No, I never did. I've been asked, you know, really.
It would be wonderful.
Perhaps someday. I have, yes, many people have wanted me to write my idea of the history of QED, and others have said you should, but I haven't really done it.
But you have done some books.
Yes, I did. The first book I wrote when I was carrying my twins. And what I did, I wrote on the basis of what I had done on the air, A Treasury of Art Songs. It was published by Boston Music Corporation. And it followed that line exactly, that we would have so many composers in that particular volume. The translations would be in English. I wrote it with my co-author, a girl I'd gone to school with, Jean Whitlock, who is, by the way, still a music teacher in New York, mostly specializing in working with children. And it went very well. And the Boston company came back to us and asked us, we already had the outline for the second volume, the Boston Music Company came to us and said, will you write the second volume? We'd like the sequel. And I had to decline, upset my friend very badly, because I was involved in developing WQED. I simply did not have the time. Remember, by that time I had 3 children and so forth. I just couldn't.
Think you might write a book?
Oh, well, I have.
I mean, about this.
If I ever get the time, maybe.
What about Famous Men and Women of Pittsburgh?
Well, that was after I left WQED.
I see.
If you remember, there was 2 years before the bicentennial. And I don't know how much of that you find of interest, but I might tell you how it developed.
I wish you would.
Well, I was one of the first members of the board of Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation. And as I saw us approaching the bicentennial, I thought, well, surely Pittsburgh, with all its cultural institutions, it was such a great city by then, will have many series of lectures on people who've done something in the city and who were contributed. So I began to go around and find out. And alas, I found out the library wasn't doing anything and the colleges weren't founding anything. And I even called up places outside of Pittsburgh where there were great universities, but near enough to us that they might be doing it, and they weren't. So I went to our board, and I mentioned that I thought a place like ours, which had been founded to preserve buildings and history for the city and its children, should do such a series. And what was the response? Oh, we think that's a fine idea, but will you do it? Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I'll try. Well, when I went to my first meeting between the City of Pittsburgh's Bicentennial Committee and the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation Committee, the first question the Joint Committee asked me, and I can't blame them, I had a whole list of who I wanted to have, you know, on such a series, but I didn't bring that up. They said, have you checked to see if there isn't any other cultural institution doing such a series in Pittsburgh? And I had to say, alas, I have, and they aren't. Well, after that, there wasn't any question. Get to it. So I brought my list to them and told them who I thought should be discussed and why. I said, I'm not quite sure who will introduce them, but I have people in mind, but I'll have to give this more time. And they said, okay, just do the series and we're behind you, but you'll have to raise the money for it. See, it wasn't enough to get the people.
I see.
You have to raise the money for it. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm.
So, I said, all right. And the first thing I did, I went to some friends who were on the board with me, and I said, now I have this person, that person, and that person. I know who will do those. But, for example, I said, I don't know a doctor, and I feel it should be a doctor, who would give a lecture on the doctor who invented the bronchoscope, and whom I knew about through a relative. The doctor's name was Dr. Chevalier Jackson.
Oh, yes.
And you've heard
I know his name, yes.
Was it because of the interest of that? Yes, the inventor of the bronchoscope. Well, I had found out about him through an early Pittsburgher who was the mother of a friend of ours, my husband and mine, and she told me what a marvelous man he was. And I felt that we needed a doctor for this. So Bill Oliver, who was my friend and who is, of course, a bibliophile of note, said, I know just the man who could do it for you, and you can use my name when you call him. And I said, all right, who is it? And he said it was Dr. Wexler, who lived in McKeesport, and who was a dermatologist by profession, but his hobby, he was also a bibliophile, Dr. Harry Wexler, his hobby was history, and he collected Jeffersoniana, was an expert on that, but he knew that he was interested in Jackson. So, of course, that was, I had the help there. And another friend of mine, Alfred Hunt, was extremely helpful, because I went to him, his mother had written a wonderful book about his direct ancestor, Captain Hunt, which of course is still in print. And I went, and Alfred was on the board, and I said, Abby, I don't know the right person, but I'll bet you would know who could do something, on, at least introduce him, in Dr. Hall, who, as you know, is the inventor of aluminum. Charles Martin Hall. And I said, I don't know the right person, and it has to be someone who knows science and someone who knows about what he did. always says, if he is well enough, I know just the person who could do that for you. And this was the man named Arthur Lindsley, who had been the head of all of public relations and all the publications for Alcoa. Very beautifully read man. He's not very well, he said, but perhaps since he knows so much about Mr. Hall, he would be willing to do it. You go and see him and use my name, which I did. And Mr. Lindsley, who was then not too well, and by the way, Mr. Hunt introduced him, and that was very nice, he gave a superb lecture the following fall on Mr. Hall. So I'm very grateful to a few friends who helped me. The most of the others, I found the people, I knew them myself, who I felt would do a great job. There is one particular one I would like to tell you about who was a friend of mine, and that was Elizabeth, now wait till I get her name here, I have to tell you that.
And, were these lectures on television as well as a book, or
No, I was interviewed on the book quite often, but both on television.